giant robot smashing into other giant robots.
All right, hey everybody, this is Ben Orenstein, and I'm here with Phil LaPierre, and this is episode 2 of the Giant Robots Smashing into Other Giant Robots podcast. So Phil, can you tell us what you do here?
So I'm a designer, do a lot of front-end development, and work with clients to basically build web applications,
Cool. So at ThoughtBot, where do we draw the line between sort of designer and development? Like, how far down the stack are you going?
Yeah. So sort of the initial start is doing sketches, wireframes after the ideation phase with a client. And then we go all the way up to prototyping in HTML and CSS and sort of stop at the point where it becomes, intense JavaScript. We do some like jQuery stuff,
right.
But not any intense programming in JavaScript. We leave that up to the developers.
Cool. Yeah, and I got to say, as a developer, I appreciate you taking off the HTML and CSS part for me, and I just get to focus on the code.
Yeah.
So it's a nice harmony. So how did you get into design?
So initially was just kind of, I think I was in high school, perhaps. I think my brother was actually, what was he doing? He had like a clan for some Xbox game or something. And so I was doing like clan websites, right?
That's hilarious.
So just kind of getting into it in that way, sort of exposed myself to HTML and CSS and new design. But initially, once I got into college, that's where it really sort of took off. And that's where I knew I wanted to do some professional and make a professional career out of doing design.
Did you study design-specific stuff at school?
Yeah, so I went to RPI and got a BA in, or sorry, a BS in graphic design.
Okay, interesting. And does that translate well into web stuff directly? Were you working on web stuff at the time?
Right, so the only web stuff I was doing was actually outside of school.
Okay.
So it's like mostly doing.
Were you
a lot
also
of
making clan websites?
No, unfortunately, I wasn't. Wasn't part of that. But
okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's mostly just doing my own personal thing, like my own website, my own portfolio, helping to teach others as well outside of school. So, I mean, that was really it. But yeah, you could apply a lot of the fundamentals that you learn in design school, basically to like the web. It translates over pretty well.
Okay. There's not too much difference between like print and web.
Not in the sense of like design fundamentals. There's definitely principles that you want to follow regardless of whether you're on print or web. So
gotcha.
Those translate over.
It's funny that you mentioned the video game websites because you're like the third designer I've talked to that got started that way. They're like a 13-year-old ish and they're playing video games and like their whatever clan or guild or whatever needs a website and they end up being the guy.
Yeah.
Like Fred, who used to work here.
Yeah.
I think at the same start was like his Counter-Strike clan.
Yeah, exactly.
Needed a website.
Yeah.
So would you consider yourself a good designer?
I mean, I think there's a level of quality you have to be able to maintain at ThoughtBot, right?
Sure.
So I would say, I'm hopefully getting better every time I'm working a new project.
Yeah.
So
what makes you good? Why, if you had to tell someone that doesn't know a lot about design, why you are skilled at design, what would you say?
Okay, so I would say it's having a good understanding of the fundamentals of design, the basic principles.
Okay.
And I think working in industry, you have to have, especially here, HTML and CSS. Like we have a very strong skill set in that. Being able to study design on your own, having a personal interest in it, it's not something that you can just think you can go to work and, and bang out some stuff. Like you have to have a level of interest that goes beyond just work. It's a life, right? Like you make a life out of this. So you have to be constantly studying and constantly learning. I think like the best designers are people who are always asking questions and always wanting to learn.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do to learn? What do you read? What are you looking at?
Yeah. So I think establishing a presence on Twitter is pretty big.
Really?
Following important people or people that are pretty well known in the industry who tweet a lot of great stuff, just links to articles, people that are pushing the boundaries and writing blog posts and stuff that you wouldn't otherwise get exposed to. But if you follow people who say are part of like the W3C or something, then you'll get like, oh, well, here's new features that are implemented to like the latest WebKit, right?
Mm.
So then you want to follow that and then you're like intrigued by that. And then, eventually that trickles down into finally when it gets into like latest browsers and you can, start working with those things.
So are you reading specs then?
Sometimes, of course.
Yeah.
Which is kind of boring and dry, but
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely times when I'm reading specs.
Yeah, I want to talk about that a little bit more when we get to bourbon.
Yeah.
So what's a good way for designers to sort of keep up with what's going on in the world and find inspiration?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, follow people on Twitter. There's people with great voices on there and, you know, always tweeting amazing resources. It's always excellent to see people's work. Get on Dribbble. That's like a great way to get your work seen by other people, even if it is just a small little snapshot. Follow people on Dribbble. You know, Dan Cederholm is here. He's, you know, he's outside, you know, Boston. And so he's like, you know, he's a designer over there at Dribbble and, you know, he's a driving force around that. And so, you know, definitely follow him. He's really cool.
Okay. Any other people on Twitter specifically that you like?
Yeah. Leah Vru, she does some pretty awesome stuff as far as front end development. She's got a great blog, good resources on there for, you know, just learning front end stuff. She, you know, speaks and take a look at her slides for any of her presentations that she does, because those are always, you know, very educated. As far as UI design goes, like Benjamin DeCock, he's doing some pretty awesome stuff. There's tons of people. Just take a look at Twitter, see who's following who, try and have a voice, and yeah, just follow the industry.
Let's switch tacks for a second. So if a developer with basically no design chops had to design his own app, and he came to you and was like, I need help. I'm about to go do this app. And you had like 2 minutes to give this guy instruction that's going to help him for the next 3 months.
To build his own app?
Yep. He's got no designer. He's got to do all the design himself. Okay. And you have like, you know, you have 60 seconds to help him.
Does this guy have a developer?
What's that?
Does he have a developer?
Oh, yeah, he's a developer. Yeah, okay. this is a developer.
Okay. So I would say look into existing frameworks that are out there. Things like Twitter Bootstrap, I think, can really help developers get up to speed and starting things really quick. It's a whole framework, right? So you've got all the CSS sort of comes with it. You know, it gives you basically things you can throw into the DOM, you know, classes and that kind of thing, which will structure your site. So I would say look at those kind of things.
So what about like fundamental principles? Like, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know nothing about design. Yeah. What should it look like? What should I do?
Right. So, I mean, I think don't try and go overly complicated with any kind of design. I think sometimes simple is better, even though that can tend to be pretty hard.
Right. It seems easier to make it more complicated a lot of the time.
Yeah, it definitely
does.
Just
keep on throwing stuff up there.
Exactly. So you know, it's you got to strip things out. You got to realize like when, you know, you've got too much on the page. Definitely think about white space. That's like a huge principle of design. Like always sort of focus on, you know, where the content is on the page, where it's flowing and how, you know, your eye sort of leads down it. And I think, and white space definitely can lead your eye down a page and through a page.
What does that mean?
Like, so you sort of have this negative space and positive space.
Okay.
And so your positive space will be the, like the actual content. So like content blocks, say maybe an article, a sidebar, that sort of thing, a header, like those are positive space. They take up the positive space. And so the negative space, the white space, is the spaces in between. And so making sure that you've got room for that, you know, positive space to breathe, that content to actually breathe inside there so that the sidebar is not too crammed on the actual article.
Okay.
That sort of thing. So making sure you've got, you know, plenty of white space.
So the fundamental rule of white space is have enough of it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you always, I don't think you can have too much white space.
Interesting.
So
when you see pages that are not designed that well, is that a typical error that you come across?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are getting better at it these days, because, you know, I think back in the days, it was just like throw as much content on a page as you can. And that's where things got crammed. But I mean, there's tons of different rules, like having good typography too really improves a page. Like you can do design just alone with having good, you know, type. So,
okay. So I'm a developer. I know nothing about type. Like I'm starting off with browser defaults. And everything is like Times New Roman or something.
Okay.
So how do I go from that and like where do I want serifs and where don't I and what size is like just again high level stuff, really basic.
Okay. So for a web page, typically you would want maybe no more than 2, possibly 3 at the max typefaces.
Okay.
I would say stick with 2. You know, one that's sort of headline fonts. So, you know, you might set like a headline in a bold like sans serif, right? Just something that like catches your eye. And then the article might be written in a serif font. So you've got contrast between those two fonts because you've got, you know, headline and the actual article. So there already is contrast between those two. Typically, your headline will be a lot already larger than your, you know, your body copy. So
yeah,
there is going to be contrast there. And so you want to sort of juxtapose those two together.
So what are common design errors you see when you find a page that you like you just don't like or you think it doesn't work? Mm-hmm. What kind of problems do they typically have?
Yeah. A lot of it is proximity issues. So things are too close to each other.
Okay. Getting back to white space.
White space, exactly. Yeah. There could be people using just really gaudy fonts, things, something like that.
So you want different fonts, but not bad fonts.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think.
And that's just something you have to develop taste around.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's seen a lot of fonts and playing with fonts before you develop a good repertoire of, you know, having, you know, fonts under your belt of what's good, what works with what fonts. Sometimes people pair fonts poorly together and that can be tricky too. So, you know, advanced designers maybe will have a better understanding of that.
Mm.
Other things is bad color choices.
Okay. So you touched on earlier the design process that we use here. Can you just sort of walk through like the first couple days if we're starting with like a brand new app, like how you talk to the client and figure out, you know, what these things are going to look like?
Yeah. So oftentimes we do, actually every time it's requirements gathering. So we meet with the client for an entire day, have a kickoff meeting, gather all the requirements for what the project is actually going to be, likely do wireframes when we're sitting with a client.
Sketched out somewhere?
Yeah, we do whiteboarding. Mm-hmm. So just sketch some stuff out on a whiteboard, very rough ideas, trying to build a mental model of the system that we're eventually going to be building. So a lot of that is just, you know, developing that yourself with whoever else on the team as well as the client. Because they often have really good feedback too.
Yeah.
So once we sort of get those requirements and we're, you know, designing out a bunch of stuff, we'll
quick question about that. Do you have questions that you typically ask, like standard questions that you like that sort of elicit the information you need?
Mm-hmm. I think it always depends on the project, depending on what you're getting at. Because, you know, every application has a different set of data and a different set of requirements that the user has to do on that page, like functionality. So a lot of it is just figuring out the data, what's going to be where, and building your own mental model of the system. And that's going to sort of drive the questions. And so you might, you know, be asking, you know, what's the most important information on this page? What goes in the header? You know, should we organize this information in a sidebar? You know, what are the most important actions that a user is going to use on this page? And that will definitely drive how the information is laid out and designed on the page, what interactions a user takes on that page.
Okay. So you've done some basic wireframing probably on a whiteboard. What happens after that?
After that is going, sort of sitting down, looking over the requirements, and then start doing some more high fidelity sketches. So I'll do those high fidelity sketches and present those or show them to the client, kind of give them a rough idea of what I'm thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
And or I will take them to Photoshop or Fireworks. Typically, I'm a Fireworks user, so I'll use Fireworks to just do like kind of a prototype, a visual prototype of what that would look like.
Okay. Are you doing any like fancy type or color at this point? Or
no, it's just like grayscale style stuff, just using Helvetica.
Okay.
So not really letting the client or myself really worry about that right now. Just get this information on there and see what functionality lives on this page or
got it. So it's about the big pieces at first and color and type don't count.
Exactly. Yeah. So nailing down those bigger pieces, it was like, you know, forming that mental model of the system. So just hitting those big pieces, how the information's laid out in the system. And then after that, it's typically doing some HTML and CSS prototypes. So not even worrying about color, fonts, anything like that. So it's just like, you know, laying it out.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really nice about that is like you're able to show the client the HTML and CSS prototype. So they're able to get a good feel of what that's actually going to look like. Maybe click through some pages.
Right. Okay. So you mentioned Fireworks. I know you prefer Fireworks over Photoshop for this sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about why?
I do. Fireworks is pretty awesome. I just recently did a project with it, and it was all the whole project was kind of delivering mockups. Mm-hmm. So what's great about it was like it gives you the ability to add pages. And so inside those, each page, you can have separate layers. So Photoshop doesn't do this. Like, there's no concept of that. There's this concept of folders in Photoshop, but it's still, all your layers are still in the same panel. So what's really great about Fireworks is it gives you this ability. You can also set, you can do like symbols. And so what a symbol is, like, you can have a collection of different elements, right? So say you've got a toolbar at the top, right? So this is your header bar, it has your navigation, all that kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. there might be like 20 different elements inside that symbol. You can create it as a symbol and then copy it to those the multiple pages. You can say, this is going to live on like 10 pages.
Interesting.
And so anytime you go to those different pages, that header bar is going to always be there. And then if you change that header bar, it reflects throughout all 10 pages.
Interesting. So it's like a sort of like a partial.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly like a partial. Yeah.
Okay. And so Fireworks was created for just like web stuff, right?
Exactly.
Photoshop wasn't.
Right.
So it's sort of a better fit.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, I've used Photoshop in the past, mm-hmm. and I just find coming to Fireworks is, it just feels a lot less bulkier. It feels a lot, you know, it just feels much more efficient, you know, lighter. The files that you're dealing with, too, are like, I don't know, a meg versus you get enough to Photoshop and you're dealing with like 30 meg files just for the same thing, you know? Mm. But the tools are definitely geared for web-specific designing around screen, basically, in web. So I find this a lot easier to use. Mm. Once you have a grasp of the tools, I'm a lot more efficient with the tools.
Hmm. Cool. So when you look back at your old work, things you've done a couple of years ago, what do you dislike about it?
Yeah. It's a good question. I feel like, you know, when I joined a few years ago, you know, still getting into the space and feeling out, you know, a lot of like the latest web sort of best practices, right? And a lot has changed in the past few years where now we have responsive design and everyone's, you know, designing so that, you know, application that you're building actually scales down to a smaller size, right? So like there's a lot that's changed, you know.
But do you look at your old stuff and go,
Of course, yeah. There's always a sense of that. And maybe it's just, you know, the more that I've actually played around and been doing web work, the better I understand how to use these tools and how to use, you know, drop shadows and color and gradients. And, you know, you find out what works the more that you do it. So, of course, there's a learning curve when you first get into the industry. And yeah, of course, I look back and say, oh, man, like, I could have did that so much better.
Yeah.
Of course, there's time constraints, too, that sort of drive your ultimate decision on something. Mm-hmm. Learning process too is really effective because, like, you know, I can look back and say, oh man, I just wasted so much time doing just like tons of Photoshop mockups on this stupid view, right? This page.
Yeah.
Versus like maybe I should actually get in there and put that data on the page in the HTML and CSS and maybe, you know, run some user testing on that and let that sort of drive, you know, what information lives there or, you know, how that could be redesigned better rather than sticking a bunch of time just iterating on, you know, 20 different Photoshop mockups. So process is absolutely fundamental to, I guess, I think, delivering good work.
Hmm. So speaking of process, something that I know you wouldn't have done a couple of years ago is use a tool like Bourbon.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what Bourbon is?
So Bourbon is a library of SAS mixins.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty lightweight. We try and make it so that it's very easy to install on your project. You just kind of drop it in and then do an include, and it just sort of lives in that space.
And you created this?
Yeah, so I created Bourbon. I say maybe that was like a year and a half ago, or maybe a year ago.
I think it was a year ago at Cape Code, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So
you're still maintaining it?
Yeah, of course I still maintain it. Yeah. But it's a great project, and so it sort of evolved out of this thing that like we're using SAS on all of our projects at Thoughtbot, and we're using SAS, and we're all creating our separate mixins. Mm-hmm. All the designers, we had 5 designers at the time, all creating mixins or using some kind of similar mixin that does the same thing.
And what's a mixin?
Mixin is So for example, we were using like a linear gradient mix-in or, so those linear gradient mix-ins have vendor prefixes in CSS. And so each of those vendor prefixes target a different browser.
Okay.
And so in order to get that linear gradient to work, you have to have, say, maybe three properties or four different properties to hit all those different browsers, make it work in all those different browsers. And so that becomes a pain to maintain. And so you can use SAS basically to basically create a mix-in so that you only have to pass that function once and then give it a color argument, two color arguments for that gradient. And then you're only dealing with that one string that you're dealing with, right? And you can change those arguments only once, and then...
So does the mixin actually generates a CSS?
Does, yeah.
So it's like a method that returns CSS almost.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep, so it just outputs the standard CSS.
Okay, so it lets you sort of step up a level of abstraction, yep. And rather than writing four lines of linear gradient, you just say, I want a linear gradient that works everywhere, and here are my arguments, and it generates what you need.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. So we had, I don't know, at this time we didn't have too many mix-ins about a year and a half ago. And so we were maybe dealing with maybe three or four mix-ins, but each person had different, like a different style or just a different, mix-in. So eventually I realized this was a pain if we were trying to go, you know, one designer went to a different project and then there was some other syntax that you had to write. Like, so it was kind of a pain. So I ended up extracting this out into a gem over Cape Code. You know, we had a week to sort of work on things. So ended up making Bourbon. And at that time, maybe it was like six or eight mix-ins, right?
Okay.
And so it's just basically grown since then. But what's nice about it is it gives us the control of sort of making these mix-ins to our needs, the way that we do things at Thoughtbot. It's very opinionated in a sense that there's no configuration file. It's basically, you know, here are the mix-ins, here are the vendor prefixes. They're up to date with the W3C spec, all that kind of stuff. So just trying to remove any kind of hassle from the users who are actually using Bourbon.
So are most of your mix-ins used to prevent you from having to deal with vendor browser prefixes, or are there other things in there as well?
There's other things in there as well. We try and hit a lot of those things that deal with vendor prefixes, but there are other functions, custom functions that we've created. There's a good grid width function in there.
What's that do?
So the grid width function is going to help you create a grid for your website so you can set up all, you can set the mixing up and the variables and stuff so that you can create basically a good grid for your website. So like the right size divs, all that kind of stuff. So you can just customize that and just set up a really solid grid.
What does grid width actually return or generate?
I mean, there's a few different things. It returns like gutters and the columns.
Okay.
So you might have like a 16 column grid, and maybe those are set up at, I don't know, like 20 pixels, and then it calculates what the gutters are going to be for those.
Can you give me an example of a non-browser prefix function that is useful in day-to-day?
Yeah, so so we have some variables in there, which are pretty cool.
Okay.
And just like font variables, so like if you want to call just a font stack, like a Helvetica font stack, it's like you'll just call, you know, $ Helvetica.
And so you've predefined a Helvetica font stack.
Font stack, exactly. Okay. So, you know, you basically want a Helvetica font stack, and then it basically is going to have whatever fallbacks there are to that, to Helvetica. So as well as there's a serifed one, like Verdana, you know, there's a few of them. So that's really nice.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Is it, so this is a gem, right?
Yeah, this is a gem.
Can you use it outside Ruby projects?
Absolutely. So we try to make it really easy to set up. You know, once you have the gem installed, or you know, you can download it right from the repo. Just throw the Bourbon files right into your style sheets directory, and then as long as you have SAS installed, you can just do a SAS watch.
Okay.
And then it, you know, works.
Cool. So, what makes a developer colleague easy to work with?
I think there's, having someone who's on a similar page. Like when I'm working with a developer, right? I want them to, you know, be respectful of my work and know like where there's sort of boundaries and where we need to meet, right? Mm. So like handing off my stuff to a developer and having a developer like meet me where we need to, to get that actually like that design functioning, that sort of thing. I think having a developer that's willing to listen is huge, and a developer that, like, when they have questions, they come to the designer, that's a specific, like, a design question, come to the designer and say, hey, like how should this be done, or how should this be laid out, or what's the design? Mm. Like, if, you know, we're working with developers, like, sometimes you'll get to a point where developers will sometimes take on, like, a design, you know, something that's, like, design, and they'll just, like, style it, or they'll do something, but the problem with that is, like, well, that's not the way that, maybe that doesn't fit into the design like the way that you thought it would or something, right? So I think, like, having a developer that, like, wants to, you know, produce really good quality work and knows where that is, like, that boundary is where they need to come to the designer and say, hey, like, you know, how should this be? And then
right.
we work on a solution to that.
Yeah, and that's, I think that, I don't know if this is unique to Thoughtbot, but typically in projects with developers and designers, you guys kind of own the way the user experience is going to run. And so I know how I'm going to implement something, roughly, but mm-hmm. I will, like, check in with you and be like, okay, so in the case that the user has no messages, what are we going to do when he goes to here? And you're going to sort of control the high-level idea of how the app is going to function.
Right. I mean, I think it's important to have a developer, like, in person, right? Because it's, like, really nice to have us in person and be mm-hmm. able to work together mm-hmm. versus working remotely or working to a point where, like, I just send stuff off to a developer that's, like, remote. Like,
sure.
Because, like, then we get, you know, that exchange of, like, you know, seeing the progress of where you are, where I am, and there's, like, a tight feedback loop of, like, what we're working on. If you have a problem and you need my help, then, like, I go there. If I have a problem, you know, I'm ready, I'm working the code, like, I'll call you over and you're able to help.
So. Yeah, one of the things I love about our workflow is that developers and designers are both pushing to the same repo. So it's a lot of fun to pull down from master, and then, like, suddenly things look better and, like, there's new elements on the page, and, like, it's really fun as a developer, like, to see your work sort of steadily getting more beautiful and more usable. And so I really like that about us. We don't sort of work independently and then jam everything together at the end. It's, like, very much iterative.
Yep.
I think it's pretty cool. Okay, so we have a few questions that came in from the Twitter sphere. The first is from Chris O'Brien. His Twitter handle is COD, and he asks, what is your best bit of advice for successfully managing the design feedback process? So I imagine he's talking about clients coming back and being like, yeah.
Clients with feedback.
I don't like this part of this or this color or whatever. Like, how do you handle that?
So I think you have to have a good working relationship with that client. Like, the way we work is we try and have a tight feedback loop with the client. So, like, every week we're meeting with the client and getting, you know, them, their eyes on the project so they can see the progress we're making, as well as just to update them on the design, right? And get feedback, solicit feedback when we need to. There's always feedback they're going to give that you're going to be like, maybe, you know, like, you don't know really design. I've been studying design for so many years.
Yeah.
Like,
how do you handle that?
It's tough. There's a good balance you have to have of saying, well, your idea sucks, it's stupid, right?
Right.
As well as, like, well, maybe actually that's a legitimate concern or mm-hmm. problem. So I think having a tight feedback loop is really helpful, because you, like, every week, so say next week I get feedback this week, maybe next week I go and maybe make some changes or something. Then I can show it to them, versus if you have really long deadlines. So you say, like, you have a 4-month project and you have a deadline, or you have a halfway point 2 months in, and then, you know, that you finally show them, like, at the end, it's just like that feedback that you got halfway through is like, you know, you've put so much time and effort into something that you've built out for two
right.
months. Like, then it's a lot harder to change and a lot harder to, you know, want to implement their feedback.
Yeah. And you have way more opportunity to go off the track from
right.
what they wanted, right?
Exactly, yeah. So you're passive urge. So if you can keep having a tight feedback loop, you have a, you know, really tight pass and you guys are on the same page. And so it makes it easier to deal with that feedback when you're dealing with it on a week by week, versus you get all the feedback, you know, all at once, maybe halfway through the project. But yeah, I mean, there's a...
So one thing our buddy, mutual friend Shamazola, said to me is that he thinks being a designer can often be tougher than being a developer, because when you're a developer, you write something, and then as long as it works, the client is happy. They never look at your code and go, That code just doesn't really pop. I don't like the color of your code.
Right.
But like when you're showing a design to someone, it can be hard to justify it. Because like they push back, they're like, oh, I don't really like these color choices. And it's not quite as concrete that you can push back and be like, no, this is a good engineering decision. It's more like, no, this is an aesthetic decision and you need to sort of trust me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like with color, it's particularly difficult because everyone has opinions about color.
Yeah, totally.
And I've dealt with it in the past and it's really tough. But I think one thing that can help is educating them on, you know, how color is perceived by people. So like certain colors, I just read an article where like orange and yellow in a design or interface is seen as cheap.
Huh.
Versus people think blue and black is expensive and high tech. So there's different things that you can, you know, ways you can educate a client to help your decision be meaningful, or they think that your color decision is good. So
yeah.
just educating them is really helpful. Bringing up articles about any kind of decisions that you've made that can help support your UI UX decisions.
Yep, makes sense. That feels sort of like the downside of, or the not as fun side of consulting. Is that sometimes at the end of the day, like they're like, I just don't like it, and you just got to kind of roll over and be like, fine.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I've dealt with that too plenty of times where sometimes you just have to hit the drawing board, or sometimes like it's hard to be, you create a design, you put so much effort into it and you try and sell it. And sometimes you try and sell it too hard and to the point where the client really doesn't like it. And then it's hard to just let it go and be like, all right, I need to go back to the drawing board. It's like you want to keep pushing that. You're so right. Like you put so much time and effort into it. And there's a really great quote by Johnny Ive that says that sums up that exact same thing, where it's just, you're selling it so hard. And at the end of the day, maybe you're just selling it too hard and it's just not the right decision. And since you're selling it too hard, it just isn't working.
Mm. Okay. So here's another question from Brian Burridge. He says, I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on Haml as part of the technology solution stack. I love SaaS, but personally think there is no reason at all to adopt Haml over a very reliable and well-honed HTML. But I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so Haml, there's a level of abstraction that like Haml does to HTML that I feel like is somewhat unnecessary. It's like I think it's easier to read HTML, as it is with, the right syntax. I think it's been around for a number of years now, right? And I think it's continuously in development. I personally like using HTML. True. That's true. But again, I sort of think of Haml as the SAS syntax or the SAS syntax of SAS or SCSS syntax of SAS.
Okay.
So it's, you're extracting out all the, open and closing brackets.
Trading it for a white space sensitivity.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it can potentially be more difficult to read, more prone to errors.
Mm. So we've standardized here on HTML, ERB, but we gave Haml a shot, I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, this is before my time, but I know this happened. So do you remember some of the issues that came up with that?
I haven't used it too frequently.
Okay.
Enough to really have a good understanding of what the major issues are.
Yeah.
But I know that like I personally like writing HTML, and when you get to using a great editor like Vim, I know you're a huge Vim fan, Ben.
Maybe, yeah, I could be.
Yeah. So it's makes writing HTML a lot easier when you have things that that fill in the closing tag for you.
Yep.
That sort of thing.
Surround.vim is my big friend there.
Exactly. Yep. So that makes writing HTML really easy.
Mm.
I don't know. I mean, it's
my takeaway from talking to some other people was that it just ended up being surprising too often. Like things that seemed like they were going to work wouldn't work, and it was bringing a level of complexity that did not justify the gain that it was giving, unfortunately. And I'm sort of sad about it because I actually really want to love Haml and I want it to work because I'm a huge believer in white space sensitivity and like the wins it can have. And so this feels a little bit like CoffeeScript to JavaScript as Haml is to HTML. And I love CoffeeScript. So I want Haml to work. I want it to win. It didn't work for us, unfortunately, but who knows, maybe in the future. We'll see. So, Phil, I appreciate you talking with me today and sharing your design knowledge and spreading it out into the world. It's been good talking to you.
Thanks, Ben. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
So we answered a couple of questions this time. And if you would like to have your questions answered, you can submit them in a couple different ways. The first is you can call us at 877-9-ROBOTS and extension 198 and leave us a voicemail. Or you can email your questions to info@thoughtbot.com. You can tweet to us at @thoughtbot, or you can even just post them on the blog. This podcast is going to be posted with a series of show notes on our blog at robots.thoughtbot.com. And if you want to check out any of the designers that Phil talked about or links to various tools that we covered, those will be there in the show notes as well. Thanks a lot and have a good day.